Well, good morning, everyone, and happy Halloween. It's a beautiful weekend for the occasion. At our house, it was frosty yesterday and this morning, and the frost was just beautiful on the scarlet leaves that had fallen off the our Japanese maple tree. Really beautiful. I hope you all had a chance to get outdoors yesterday and again today. So we are actually right on the day of Halloween this year, and it's also the time of year that we traditionally do our ceremony for offering the nourishment of the Dharma to the beings in the hungry ghost realm, which I will talk more about in a bit. But it's also the time in pre-Christian Celtic tradition. You know, the Celtic culture spanned what's now United Kingdom, but also into France. And the ancient Celts celebrated a festival called Samhain. Maybe I'm pronouncing that right. When the harvest was over and the cold winter months were beginning, it was believed that the veil between this world and the other world, the afterworld of the dead, the veil became thinner. And the spirits of the dead came to visit or to haunt. And you can see how this association came about, you know, as the leaves fall and the garden vegetables turn kind of brown and the plants get kind of slimy, the days grow long and dark. So on the eve of Samhain, bonfires were lit and people would take coals home to the hearth for the winter months from that big bonfire. And offerings were made to the gods for protection through the harsh months of winter. You know, the winter of sometimes starvation, illness, harsh conditions. And two traditions were called mumming and guising. You ever heard those words? Mumming and guising. So mumming was singing or chanting, offering songs or chants, and guising was putting on masks, disguises. And then receiving food in return. And whether those costumes or masks were to imitate the spirits or to ward them off is unclear. And then over time, the Christian tradition of the Feast of All Saints began around the 4th century to honor the saints of old. And by around the 8th century, it came to be celebrated at exactly the same time, pretty much the same time as Samhain, around November 1st, with October 31st becoming All Hallows' Eve, hence Halloween. And it may well be that it was culturally grafted onto the old pre-Christian tradition. And so now we have fireworks, costumes, trick-or-treating, lots of merchandise, and neither the gods nor the dead have much to do with it. But we do have a relationship with the dead. And it's been compelling for us human beings for millennia of culture and religion. Do the dead lie easy in their graves, or do they come back to haunt us? Do the dead lie easy in our hearts and minds, or do they come back to haunt us, or to visit us with gifts? We humans have been puzzling over this great matter of life and death ever since we became conscious of death, probably before we were even quite human, because of course some of the very intelligent animals have an awareness of death and of the dead. Maybe you've heard stories of elephants tending the bones of their dead stroking them, going to the boneyard, their place of where the bones lie, and touching them gently. Isn't that amazing? Elephants do that. We humans have attended carefully to the bodies of our dead in so many different ways over the span of our existence. The earliest human burial yet discovered dates back 78,000 years. It was found in a cave on the coast of Kenya. A boy child of about 3 years old laid carefully on his side and placed in a kind of depression, like a little pit. And from his positioning, it was speculated that he had been wrapped in some kind of shroud with something to support his head 78,000 years ago. Other early archaeological sites yield evidence of ceremonies for the dead, evidence of flowers, objects buried with the dead. So we've been doing this for a very long time, tending our dead and making places where we can go to remember them. And when those places are lost, the dead go unremembered, untended, and the connection is broken. As with the unmarked graves of the indigenous children who died in residential schools, whose graves have been rediscovered. Michael and I, when we were away a couple of weeks ago, took a walk in Pennsylvania in a beautiful wildflower preserve. We went there because my mom loved this place, and so I wanted to go and in her memory and be there with her, a sense of her loving this place. And so we tried to do this circuit, and we missed the turn, and we ended up on another trail through the forest that was partly on, we were trespassing private land, the sign said, but we kept going respectfully, and we discovered this old cemetery completely in the forest. Old stones, some of them tilted, some of them just little worn stones without, but the many of them went back to late 18th century, and they were German immigrants. There were, some of them were the words on the stones were in German for some of them, and it was the most beautiful spot. It's so still and peaceful, just the leaves rustling in the trees. We sat there for some time, and someone had gone and put tiny white flags identifying each grave. So someone had obviously, you know, been there and tended and studied this place. It was remarkable just to kind of stumble upon it and to know that it was cared for. These were probably German Mennonites fleeing religious persecution at that time. So, and I also just read an article in the New Yorker about the rediscovery, in some cases, and reclaiming of Black American cemeteries throughout the south and east of the states that are now being claimed, tended. You know, many have been paved over, many are maybe under a mall parking lot now. But these sites are being tended. And I also went, when I was a little girl, I lived in the country, and there was a big woods that I used to walk through and come out the other side, and there was this, at the time, little cemetery. And it was called, colloquially, the Colored Cemetery. It was where the black residents of my little town were buried, separately from the big cemetery where my family plot lies. And it used to be a little bit of a, it wasn't cared for in those days. It was overgrown and it was a little bit spooky, and yet somehow I liked to go there. I felt like, I don't know, even as a little girl, I liked to go there. And Michael and I stopped by there on our travels as well, and it's been completely, it's just beautifully cared for. And there's a memorial to the war veterans. this is a bigger story than I meant to tell. But for me, as a ostensibly a pacifist who left my country because of unjust war, I couldn't understand the veneration of the veterans that black Americans feel until I read a book by two women who were in high school, from my hometown, who in high school the same time I was, two black women who were involved in taking care of the cemetery, restoring the cemetery. And they then researched the history of black Americans in this small town and valley where I grew up, and wrote an amazing, beautiful, detailed history and book about it called If These Stones Could Talk. And one chapter was devoted to veterans, and I said, I got it, because they detailed veterans who fought in the American Revolution and in the Civil War and the First World War and the Second World War, and how they were treated, in each of these cases, and how their service in the war brought ultimately recognition and played a big role in the civil rights movement in the 60s. So, suddenly I had a completely different view. And it shows how even a deeply felt commitment to nonviolence, to pacifism, can be narrow, can be not quite enough to hold the complexity. I wasn't even going to include this in this talk, but it's just up for me, this history, the complexity of our human history. So the point of bringing this up is that this relationship to the dead is also the relationship to the past, right? And these movements to reconnect to the dead, the lost dead, are also recognitions of wrongs and injustices done. So it's layered. And so what I'm getting to is also that many traditional cultures have ways of maintaining an ongoing connection to the dead, unlike our secular, rational, materialist culture, which says, oh yeah, take a few days of bereavement leave and then get back to business as usual, right? So maybe we can learn a thing or two from the old ways. Buddhist traditions in China and Japan are influenced by the Confucian value of venerating one's ancestors. So in Japan, each household has a Buddhist altar upon which are often photos of those who have died, grandma and grandpa. And at certain times of the year, or quite frequently, little offerings are made, little rice and water. And certain times of the year, sutras are chanted. And I guess maybe this tradition is waning because people live in tiny little apartments and urban apartments, but there are little little butsudan, little Buddhist altars for them too. Some years ago, on one of our Sangha trips to Japan, we stayed at Rinzoin, the home temple of Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, who founded San Francisco Zen Center. So we stayed. Well, his son is abbot there, and his grandson basically runs the temple. And so we've developed a kind of very warm relationship with the family. And on that trip, I went to visit Suzuki Roshi's wife, who was approaching her 100th birthday. And I had done a translation project of her haiku poetry to be presented in honor of her birthday. So I got to take the manuscript to show her. And she lived with her daughter a short ways from the temple. And the very first thing she did was take me to the butsudan, the family altar, and introduce me to Suzuki Roshi. And it was like an introduction. It wasn't just showing. It was... And her first husband, who had been killed in World War II. I was really moved by that, the very first thing we did. And so it's not unusual for Japanese family members to go and sit at the altar and report to grandma or grandpa on how things are going, you know, with the kids, and any successes or challenges, and receive some advice. Not unusual. And in August, during the Obon festival, the whole family goes to the cemetery plot, often traveling quite some distances from cities to back to the rural hometown. And they clean and decorate the graves. It's a festive occasion. It's maybe a little bit like Dia de los Muertos in Mexico, yeah? There are food offerings and flowers to welcome the dead to who come visit. That's the time of year they come visit. And then you may have seen photos of beautiful lanterns floating on the river to light the way back to the other realm for the dead, the spirits. And I must say, they have the very best fireworks displays ever I have seen at this time. But it's a gentle way of ensuring that the ancestors are remembered and included in family life. And also maybe of healing those hauntings of troubled relationships and traumatic wounds over the years, a way of doing that. There are special cemeteries in Japan that were created after World War II, where the remains were interred of those who had no living family members left to tend their graves. These spirits are called muen botoke. So mu means no, en means connection, botoke, Buddha. So the dead are often referred to as hotoke, as Buddhas. These spirits were no connection, connectionless Buddhas, muen botoke. And they are included in ceremonies that offer offerings to the hungry ghost realm. They're not exactly hungry ghosts, but they're included, the muen botoke. So we might consider that today, those who have no one to tend their graves or remember them. Now, the hungry ghost realm is one of the six realms of existence that you may have seen depicted in the Tibetan Tanka Wheel of Life, right? Six divisions. Up at the top is the heavenly realm, down at the bottom is the hell realm, to the right is the human, and then below that, the hungry ghosts. Over on the left is the angry, jealous, fighting gods. They're called Asura. They're the type A personalities. And then down to the below them, between them and the hell realm, is the animal realm. Yeah. And I'm not going to go into all of them now, but I find them really, these realms, not so much as literal realms of reincarnation in the traditional sense, but descriptive of states that we inhabit in our daily life, right? Sometimes in a single day, we can fall from the heavenly realm right down to the hell realm, right? Or any of those others. But the hungry ghosts are depicted with long, skinny necks and distended bellies and emaciated arms and legs because they're always hungry, craving, trying to fill the emptiness they feel. But when they eat, it's painful. Their throats burn. They have perpetual indigestion. They're hungry, hungry, hungry. Never satisfied. Their craving has a kind of desperate edge that tells us it's more than animal hunger for food or for sex. Beneath the hungry ghost hunger is the craving for love and acceptance. This is the state that characterizes those whose early bonds of love were not securely formed. It's the pain of this emotionally bereft and needy state that's often masked in our culture or anesthetized by addictive behaviors, right? Food, alcohol, drugs, money, gambling, work, sex, shopping, the list goes on and on. And our consumer culture reinforces the hungry ghost realm powerfully because it's highly profitable. We learn that we should get what we want as soon as possible, and that pain is something to be eliminated as soon as possible. Discomfort, ugh, right? And how many in our culture dwell in a pervasive state of lack despite our, you know, relative wealth as a nation? How many dwell in a state of not enough, not enoughness, conditioned by all the different ways that we are conditioned? In each of those six realms, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, appears with a gift. And the gift she offers to the hungry ghosts is a bowl containing the food of the Dharma, the nourishment of the Dharma. So hence the ceremony of offering food of the Dharma to the hungry ghost realm. There are different origin stories about this custom. There's one in the Pali Canon, the early texts of the Buddha's disciple Shariputra rescuing his mother from hell. And in a later Chinese Mahayana text, the character is changed to a different disciple, Moggallana, or Mulian in Chinese, who asks the Buddha for help to rescue his mother, who's suffering the torments of hell because she was so stingy in life. Or it makes more sense maybe to be in the hungry ghost realm, but anyway, she was definitely in the lower half of the wheel. And the Buddha instructs Moggallana to make offerings of food to the monasteries on the 15th day of the 7th lunar month. And this is said to be, this is said to be the origin of, again, the ceremonies feeding the hungry ghosts, to help them be reborn into a human realm, because the human realm is where we are best situated to practice the Dharma and to awaken. The legend of Mulian becomes quite an elaborate story with him visiting the different realms and praying for his mother as she undergoes successive reincarnations from the hell realm to the hungry ghost realm and to the animal realm. She appears as a black dog and then eventually to the human realm. It's quite a story. This legend spread through China to Japan, Vietnam, Korea. And I think it offered a way to reconcile that strong Confucian value of filial piety, of duty to take care of one's parents, with the Buddhist value of non-attachment. So what you wish, you know, for the dead is traditionally to be reborn into a human realm. But I think there's something that resonates about the story even today. That desire to save our parents from a kind of afterlife suffering, right? Or the dead, it might be our parents, for them to be healed even beyond death into wholeness and peace that perhaps they did not have in life. And when it's the case of our parents, I think even beyond death, we long for them to be healed into the ability to love us unconditionally the way we always wished they could. So this ceremony gives us an opportunity to remember our ancestors and others who have died, to reflect on anything unresolved, the pain in their lives that lingers in those still living, in our own lives, and to invoke the good medicine of the Dharma to heal that pain, to nourish that hollow space of longing for love, acceptance, and forgiveness. And we also extend our care to those living in this world, in the realm of the hungry ghosts, those struggling with addiction, loneliness, estrangement, pervasive dissatisfaction, and to the hungry ghost within each of us when we feel not enough, not enough love, not enough money, not enough success. You each could make a list of your not enoughs. These cravings in us, as we know, are conditioned by our human life, our habit patterns that go back generations. So, of course, in offering nourishment of the Dharma to the dead, we offer it to ourselves and to future generations, right? To everyone our lives touch, and then to everyone their lives touch. And this is what we call purifying karma. So our relationship to the dead is alive and evolving. If you've experienced the death of someone close to you, you've probably observed over time the way your experience of them or even your memory changes as you get older and hopefully a little wiser. For those who've lost a parent in childhood or in youth, often reaching the age that parent was when they died is a real threshold that can open up insights into that parent's life, to compassion for them, compassion for yourself at that time in your life. I sometimes think that our relationship to past and future is often an effort to understand and control our lives so that nothing bad happens to us or those we love, right? So we're just going to see if we can control our story about the past and the future. To think about the past and the future, we have to imagine past and future to form images in our mind, right? Now you might say, well, yes, I'm imagining the future, but the past, that really happened. Right? Think again. When we use our memory, we construct images in our mind or verbal replays of conversations. And these reconstructions are not the experience itself. When we remember something from the past or imagine something in the future, we are having that experience of remembering or imagining in the present. Or at least as close to the present as our brain is capable of. It's really important, and our practice really supports us to recognize this, to recognize that memory and foresight are always partial, always provisional, always constructed from our limited perspectives and views, always subject to revision and change, as are our relationships with the dead. You have probably noticed how different family members have such different memories of the same incident. Have you noticed some discrepancies? Yeah. Or maybe you've convinced yourself that you remember and were present on an occasion when it turns out you couldn't possibly have been, and you're remembering it from a photo or a family story. Right? The more we look into the nature of memory and imagination, the more we see into the nature of time itself. And this, I think, is key to our relationship with the past, and for that matter, the future. Last week, I listened to an interview with the Russian poet Maria Stepanova about a book she wrote that just came out called In Memory of Memory. Isn't that a great title? It's not a book of poetry, but it's a book of prose, but also just kind of collage with photographs and letters. It's a kind of mixed genre book. And it's about how her Jewish family lived through the persecutions of the last century in Russia. And she said in the interview, "The book is a love story of sorts because I am writing about this obsessional love that is directed backwards towards this family of mine that I was never properly able to embrace because they were long dead. And so the conversation is one-sided, and you're loving someone who cannot pay you back." And then the interviewer quoted from the book, quoted Stepanova, who says, "To make the dead speak, we have to make space for them in our own bodies and minds, carry them inside us like the unborn." Huh. So we carry both our ancestors and those to come within us. Because as Dogen Zenji said, Dogen Zenji being the founder of our school of Zen in Japan, he said, "Everything that comes forth in the study of the way is the true human body. The entire world of the 10 directions is nothing but the true human body. The coming and going of birth and death is the true human body." So Dogen wrote about time and our human existence in terms of living and dying. He said, "Know that through causes and conditions, a human body in this lifetime is a temporary assemblage. Further, it is born and perishes moment by moment without ceasing. It is born and perishes at each of the 65 moments contained within one finger snap. But because of ignorance, we don't notice it." What a pity that although we are born and perish at each moment, we don't notice it. I really love this passage because, as it turns out, it corresponds to contemporary neuroscience. The Sanskrit word that Dogen uses here in Japanese, the Sanskrit word is kshana. And when you look it up in a Buddhist dictionary, it says that a kshana is 1/75th of a second. The neuroscientist Francisco Varela once studied the time it takes a subject to recognize an image. And I'm going to spare you all the numbers. but he actually timed the gap. There's a little tiny gap before there's a stimulus and there's any brain activity at all. There's a little gap there. There's another little gap before there's recognition. Which is sort of a non-conceptual recognition. There's seeing, right? But it's not yet identified. And then there's another little gap before the recognition occurs. And then there's something called, I love this, synchrony scatter. Synchrony scatter is when then there's this little moment of recognition and neurons start firing up all through the brain. And that's where memory comes in, right? That's where we identify, okay, it's black and it's fuzzy and it sounds like that and it's a dog, right? Oh, but a dog bit me when I was 3, so I'm scared, you know, and then that's synchrony scatter. And then there's our reaction. So it might be, right? Fight, flight, or freeze, or it might be, oh, come here, let me pet you. And there are little gaps in each of those places, and the total gap adds up to be very, very close to Dogen's finger snap, to that kshana, that 1/75th of a second. Isn't that amazing? It's like, so we can't even be here now. It's gone that fast, right? By the time we say it's a dog. So what we can do is sit down in zazen. We can slow down, we can breathe in and out. We can pay attention to our moment-to-moment experience of body and mind. When we do that, we soon enough see that sensations, perceptions, feelings, insights, memories, replayed or imagined conversations will arise and pass away. Phenomena of the body and mind are arising, are being born and dying in each moment, just like Dogen said, right? Insubstantial as a dream, but arising through this medium, this living body and mind, and yet not bounded by it. The world is constantly flowing through us. We are constantly interacting with the world. And all our preciously held ideas and memories and stories about our family and our ancestors are all provisional, partial, subject to change. So we can begin a little bit to relax our grip on them, to open up to the more spacious story within which our lives arise and pass. Even as we fully accept the particularity of this never-to-be-repeated lifetime. Dogen says, being time has a characteristic of flowing. So-called today flows into tomorrow. Today flows into yesterday. Yesterday flows into today. And today flows into today. Tomorrow flows into tomorrow. This is typical Dogen. And then he lists some of the Zen ancestor. Qingyuan is time, Huangbo is time, Mazu is time, Shurto is time, because self and other are already time. So this flowing quality of time that Dogen describes, it is not sequential, and yet it's moving. And he lists those Zen ancestors. Have you ever felt as though the ancestors are sitting with us in the Zendo? Sometimes at Sesshin particularly, I feel that. It helps. It helps. But you could substitute the names of your own ancestors. Not just as distant figures in the past, but as living presences in our life and practice. Self and other, not separate in space or time. I'm sure many of you may have experienced the death of someone you loved deeply, and you felt that sharp pain of their absence that we call grief, missing, yearning. And maybe also you felt, even fleetingly, a vivid sense of their presence. Sometimes they come in dreams as a haunting or a blessing. Or you're blindsided by a vivid memory coming in the midst of a trip to the supermarket, or a song that plays on the radio. When I used to work as a hospice counselor and people would tell me these things, they'll think, you're going to think I'm crazy, but... And then they'd tell me one of these stories and I would say, no, I don't think you're crazy. If it feels like a gift, receive it as a gift. There's no way to describe these experiences very well without sounding all woo-woo. But poets try and come closest. So I'm going to close this rambling talk with a few poems. So this first one is by Robert Bly. It's called When My Dead Father Called. Last night I dreamt my father called to us. He was stuck somewhere. It took us a long time to dress. I don't know why. The night was snowy and there were long black roads. Finally we reached the little town, Bellingham. There he stood by a street lamp in cold wind, snow blowing along the sidewalk. I noticed the uneven sort of shoes that men wore in the early 40s. And overalls, he was smoking. Why did it take us so long to get going? Perhaps he left us somewhere once, or did I simply forget he was alone in winter in some town? So that was a dream, that came in a dream. It was a dream of the dead being cold and lonely. This one's different. This is by May Sarton. August 3rd. These days, lifting myself up like a heavy weight, old camel getting to her knees, I think of my mother and the inexhaustible flame that kept her alive until she died. She knew all about fatigue, and how one pushes it aside for staking up the lilies early in the morning, the way one pushes it aside for a friend in need, for a hungry cat. Mother, be with me. Today on your birthday, I am older than you were when you died, 35 years ago. Thinking of you, the old camel gets to her knees, stands up, moves forward slowly into the new day. If you taught me one thing, it was never to fail life. That's a little different way that the dead stay with us. And then the future is with us all the time too. This is W.S. Merwin. For the anniversary of my death. Every year, without knowing it, I have passed the day when the last fires will wave to me and the silence will set out, tireless traveler, like the beam of a lightless star. Then I will no longer find myself in life as in a strange garment, surprised at the earth and the love of one woman and the shamelessness of men. As today, writing after 3 days of rain, hearing the wren sing and the falling cease, and bowing, not knowing to what. So thanks to the poets, and thank you to you for listening patiently to me rambling on. Let's chant together, and then we will do our ceremony.
Okay. Page
three. Oh, share screen. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow.